May it please the court, I'm Malcolm McConnell of the Richmond Bar. I represent the appellant, Stephanie Herring, who is the plaintiff below in this automobile accident trial that took place in the Circuit Court of Fluvanna County. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. Unless the court prefers otherwise or has questions, I'd like to begin with a brief, clear, and concise statement of the applicable law and then discuss the facts of this case. Although several precedents inform this appeal, we really need look no further than Bradner versus Mitchell to know that the trial court below erred.
So you agree that this case doesn't come under the Bowers v. Sprouse rationale?
I believe that the case, that all of these cases inform this appeal, as we've laid out in our brief. Traditional, when you don't have the exact amount of specials claimed, then obviously there needs to be a transition. Clearly, this is not that case.
Okay.
So it has to be, we have to look at it according to traditional tort principles, which shifts us over to Bradner.
Right.
I don't believe we leave Bowers v. Sprouse behind. I believe, as I say, it informs the decision, but it's not the exact jumping off point for the decision in this case. So as Bradner clearly states, that where a plaintiff's evidence of special damages is uncontroverted and so complete that no rational fact finder could disregard it, it becomes a fixed constituent part of the verdict. And if there is no compensation for non-monetary damages, the verdict is insufficient as a matter of law and must be reversed. When the parties agree on an issue, it is by definition uncontroverted, and no rational finder of fact properly instructed under the law can disregard that.
Well, I know that the defendant's expert acknowledged that there was a certain span of time that he agreed that the treatment that was rendered in that span of time was appropriate, was necessary, related to the accident. But I find various numbers in the record. I mean, sometimes, because the expert doesn't give a number. So the defendant's attorney talks about a $5,000 or $5,600. I take it there was some sort of demonstrative exhibit that the defendants used that did not come into evidence that had an exact number on it, and that this verdict is a few cents different than that number.
There was a demonstrative exhibit that was used, Your Honor, but it wasn't just, there was the statement of damages, and the total of the figures for what the defense expert, Dr. Andrews, conceded was, I believe, about 49 cents more than the actual verdict.
I've tried every way from here to Sunday to calculate those numbers, and I can't get them to come out to that number.
Well, that may be, Your Honor, and of course, and forgive me, I was not present in the courtroom, but I've had the benefit of the record as the court has had. And we do have various statements, various incidents, in addition to the defense expert, Dr. Andrews. We have the defense opening statement on page 141 of the appendix, where defense concedes approximately $5,500, making a general statement in his opening. Then Dr. Andrews quantifies on page 43 of the appendix that period of time. And, of course, that period of time, the charges for that period of time, is what the plaintiff is relying upon and what the defendant is now conceding. Then the defense stands up on closing and says $5,000, approximately $5,600, is the appropriate level. The jury question comes back, what's the exact amount? Now, the jury doesn't hear this, but the defense counsel concedes for the record and to the trial court, which of course ultimately makes this decision whether to set the verdict aside, that the amount was $5,649. That's at page 206 of the appendix. So we take the record as a whole, And clearly, we have a concession as to a certain amount of special damages.
To the extent that we tell the jury that the lawyer's opening statements are not evidence, how would we then expect the jury to rely on what you call the concession in the opening statement to be evidence of what the damages would be?
Well, I believe we need to make a distinction between what the jury can consider as evidence and what the position that parties are taking at trial for purposes of trial court decisions and for purposes of appellate review. And the defense counsel, regardless of whether he's saying something that should be considered evidence by the jury, I think that what defense counsel says in opening statement is staking out a position and laying claim to a position for the purposes of the record, for the purposes of the trial court, and for the purposes of appellate review.
But can't the jury disagree with what the defense counsel states out in opening statement?
They absolutely can, Your Honor. So we shift to what the evidence is. The bills, the medical bills that came in, the testimony of Dr. Andrews. The
Dr. Andrews was the
defense expert.
And he points to physician's bills, the ER visit, and the physical therapy. But he points to those three things. And like the chief, I've done the math several times, and I cannot, for the life of me, using those three elements, come up with $5,600 or $5,700.
I understand that, Your Honor. And certainly every appellant wishes that a record is cleaner in one respect or another than it ultimately turns out to be. However, we do have the defense concession to the court, and the jury and the defense representation during closing argument to what those figures are. And the question clearly indicates that this is where the jury is going. So they were drawn to the demonstrative exhibit by remarks by defense counsel, and the defense counsel conceded for the record, and the figures are there. There is no dispute as to $5,600 of special damages between the parties. The defense can't come into the Supreme Court of Virginia and say, we dispute $5,600 in specials, when they stood up in front of the trial court, whether before the jury or before the judge or both, and said, this in fact is the undisputed part of the special damages. They cannot acrobate in the trial court and reprobate in the Supreme Court. And once it becomes that uncontroverted figure, the finder of fact cannot disregard it, and it must be set aside because there is no compensation for the non-monetary side of the case.
So I understand your position to be that whether you can actually get to the penny or not, you have an opening statement, you have a closing statement that has what amounts to some sense of agreement about it. You have the testimony from the doctor, the defense doctor. You have a question from the jury. You have a defense counsel's response to the judge to that question. And then you have the Bradner case. So any way you look at it, there's no award of damages for pain and suffering and inconvenience, and that's why you ask it to be reversed.
That is absolutely true, Your Honor. We cannot be hung up on, you say, whether it comes to the penny or not. We're going to be elevating form over substance, I'm afraid, if we do that.
Well, like it's been said here, I can't come up with this number either, but Dr. Andrews did not testify to any amounts of expenses and only identified some of the providers, as Justice Powell indicated. Is that right? I just want to make sure I'm straight on what the doctor actually did.
Dr. Andrews did not directly address the money, the bills.
Right,
that
okay.
Answers Your Honor's question.
Okay.
And the question from the jury, after having heard defense counsel's opening statement and defense counsel's closing statement, was, what is the exact amount from Dr. Andrews for the medical bills 3 months from the accident? And so they're focusing on the evidence, and they're asking, what if we look at this chart that Dr. Andrews testified to? And so if you add up Andrews, it comes to about $3,700. And so there would be pain and suffering if that was the jury's thought process, wouldn't it?
If the figure were $3,700, that
from what the three factors Dr. Andrews testified to add up to about $3,886.
If the thought process of the jury was such that it addressed bills that were in dispute, and then reached a decision that was, and bills that were not in dispute, and then reached a verdict for an amount that was greater than that amount, then yes, ma'am, there would be some compensation for non-monetary damages. Clearly from the record, that is not what happened here.
There's a reference to something that was used in closing argument that was not given to the jury. And then on page 229, there is an exhibit that bears the trial judge's initials, which would tend to indicate that it was received into evidence and given to the jury. But my question is, there a missing chart?
There was a demonstrative chart, Your Honor, a blow-up that was used in front of the jury that was not made part of the record.
Well, you know, I can't get these numbers to get to work either. But I get the idea that the defense counsel's answer to the judge's response to the jury is the same answer that the jury came up with the exception of 55 cents. So perhaps that chart would reconcile the numbers to demonstrate how they got there.
I believe there's no question about that, Your Honor. The appellant prays that this court, for the reasons stated in the briefs and this morning, reverse the trial court, set the judgment aside, and remand for a new trial on damages only.
All right, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Chris Rothman. I'm here on behalf of the appellee. If the court has no questions at this time, I will address some of the issues that I feel were addressed in the appellant's argument. Particularly, I think it is worth pointing out, first and foremost, this is a case where the appellee has a jury verdict that has been affirmed by the trial court, and all reasonable inferences, of course, should be drawn in the light most favorable to him based on the record as it is. The main thing I want to address is that there was no evidentiary stipulation of an exact amount. And I will agree with the court. I have gone over the numbers again last night and the night before. I could not get to the number in which I arrived at and what I referred to the judge. And that was my interpretation of the evidence. And I think the jury is entitled to their own interpretation of the evidence as well. And I think that's what's critical here, is if the number they came up with based on the actual evidence presented to them is reasonable, then the court shouldn't speculate as to how they got to that number. And what was the actual evidence in this case? I think that is critical.
Mr. Gatlin, you were the lawyer.
I was, Your Honor.
Well, when the jury came back with their question, and of course the judge simply told them to follow the instructions, which is probably the right thing for him to do. But when he came back with a question, the judge asked then counsel what the damages were, and according to the record, you said $5,649.55. Now, we can't get Exhibit 1 to get to that. How did you get to it?
I'm not sure. I wish I knew, Your Honor, and that's why I don't know how I got to that figure. But based on, if you look also at the record, there's the actual bills that are for various providers, whether it be the emergency room bill, any diagnostic testing that was done. I don't know how I got to that figure, but that was my interpretation. And I think the jury is then entitled to their own interpretation as well.
Well, if they come back with a verdict that differs by 55 cents, it would seem to me that whether this is penny to the penny, to the dollar, you know, rounded off up or down by $10 or whatever, it represents a discrete part of special damages and does not represent pain and suffering, which runs afoul of Bradner. So why don't you address that?
I think then we get into this speculation, this guessing, and maybe we were on the same page, maybe we weren't, because you have to look at the actual evidence. Bradner was easy in the sense that Bradner, there was no contest whatsoever, and there was significant injury. And so when the $40 above in that case was rendered, it's an easy decision that it wasn't adequate. But here with the actual facts, with the medical evidence that was presented, there's very limited testimony, and it's Dr. Andrews is number one. And what does Dr. Andrews say? He says the emergency room bill, the physical therapy, and the PCP. Well, what does that leave out? That's a variety of things that are left out. Additional diagnostic testing that was done days after, prescription medication that was taken throughout the time period, whether it be in the 3 months or not. And if you look at it that way, there is a dispute then that, as the justice pointed out, there could be about $3,700 in bills. If you look at it like that, if that's a reasonable interpretation based on the evidence that's presented, well, then is it adequate with the verdict they reached? And the answer is yes. They've considered then something in terms of pain and suffering. Under that situation, it's speculation if that's not what they did. While we came to a close number in the sense we're off, I understand there's hesitation with that. But as soon as you start down the path of speculating what the jury did or did not do, I think you have to defer to the trial court's verdict, the verdict that was affirmed. And that's the critical distinction in this case, that there is grounds for reasonable interpretation based on the actual evidence. Now, my opening and closing, I give out rough estimates, again, based on my interpretation of the limited evidence. The jury had very few things to look at when they went back in the jury. One was the photographs of the vehicles, which demonstrates to some degree the nature of this actual accident. And two, the statement of damages the court referred to earlier, along with the actual bills. The jury had the ability to flip through that, to pick out the bills that they felt were related based on the testimony. Now, if counsel wanted to have a true stipulation, there's a couple ways to do that.
One, well, before you, there's a lot of ways to have a stipulation, but I mean, in the real world, when defense counsel stands up and says to a jury, we're reasonable people, and we actually agree that there's some damage in this case, and here's what we think was reasonable, and then does it again in the closing, and then in response to a jury question, tells the judge to the penny what that amount is, do we have to have something as formal as a stipulation to reach the understanding that you agreed, they agreed, and that it was a constituent part of the verdict that was limited only to special damages? Do we have to have something formalized?
I think to an extent that was never presented to the jury, that to the penny amount, I think yes, that you do need a formal stipulation at that point. If there was nothing that's presented as evidence to the jury, simply to the fact finder, I don't know how you can't have that presented to the jury. So I do think you need that. And again, the figures they reach, not being able to do the math, you're not sure which one they came to. And with that guesswork, I think it gets you closer to some of the Walker decisions in terms of what is adequate, that, whether it be $50 or $70. Then it depends on the facts. Based on the bills that the jury could have looked at, they could have considered, which again, with the reasonable interpretation, there is potential for compensation for pain and suffering. I think a key component then is also plaintiff's counsel never cross-examined Dr. Andrews on what bills were related. He had that opportunity to draw that out to make it as clear as possible. It is vague when you review the testimony of Dr. Andrews. It's vague what he's actually referring to in terms of specific bills. Without that cross-exam, which could have been done, he's not locked in. And again, if the jury doesn't believe that certain things within that period, which weren't testified to, that those weren't what Dr. Andrews was agreeing to, well, then I think it's perfectly reasonable the figure they came to. And I think based on that, that it's clear that they did have some type of award for pain and suffering. And that's truly the evidence we're left with. There's nothing else evidentiary before the jury to consider at that point. Looking again then at the Walker v. Cressy and the 257 Virginia 65, you get into that idea, again, that was a case of only about $86 above what were the specials in that case. And again, those were completely contested, but it provides guidance to adequacy. I think the first part test, obviously, deals with reasonableness and whether the verdict was reasonable, and then you get to adequacy. And I think the Walker cases provide that guidance in terms of what was adequate. And under these facts, under the nature of the accident, the nature of the alleged injuries, adequacy here is fine and is acceptable if we believe that the jury reasonably reached their verdict. And I think the fact that we're having all the questions with the math and the limited evidence really, again, gets into what Williams v. Simmons was in the same citation dealing with speculation. If we're speculating as to what the evidence could lead the jury to believe, well, then you have to leave the verdict alone. And I think that's what's appropriate here. Yes, the jury did come back with a question as well. That could have been the question of one juror. That could have been the question of all the jurors. I don't think it's fair to begin to speculate as to what the jury was doing. I think the court has been clear on that in terms of notations on paperwork found in the jury room versus what a one jury question may be. I don't think reliance on that is appropriate, and again, it leads to speculation and conjecture at that time. So, for those reasons, Your Honor, for the court, I would ask that the judgment be affirmed as is, as reasonable, as adequate, as a reasonable interpretation of the limited evidence that was presented, and And if the court has no further questions, I thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal? Mr. McConnell, I'd like to ask you to explain how this case differs from the three cases that are encompassed with the Walker versus Mason decision. They came after Bowers, and in each of those cases, the court concluded that the trial court had incorrectly applied Bowers, but then we went on to say in each case that the original verdict should stand. And for instance, in the Walker case, there was a verdict amount of $230, which was exactly the amount of the emergency bill from the hospital. And we said because of the evidence of damages was controverted that that could not be set aside as a matter of law. And it's sort of the same thing is occurring in each of those three cases that are encompassed with that one opinion. How is this case different? Because you've got a number that it probably represents some amount of damages that everybody agreed to. We can't quite pin it down to exactly what because of the numbers. But the evidence here was controverted about the extent of her damages that were caused as a result of this accident. So tell me how this case isn't one of those cases.
Yes, ma'am. The difference is that in those cases, all of the evidence was contested, was controverted. In this case, only some of the evidence was contested or controverted. And it is that evidence that we are focusing on. It would be very nice to have a piece of paper in the record that was shown to the jury that had this exact number on it. We do not have it. But we have a set of circumstances taking the record in its totality. It defies description that a statement made by defense counsel outside of the presence of the jury is the exact same figure that the jury brought back when they're both using the same touchstones, relying upon when they're reaching their figures in separate rooms. It is impossible as a practical matter to decide that that is some coincidence and that therefore that somehow they accepted a lesser number than defense counsel conceded and then added non-monetary damages to reach the exact figure that defense counsel conceded. Can't happen that way. I mean, that's just not realistic. A piece of paper would be nice. I'm sorry we don't have it. But we have a record in its totality which makes clear that the rational finder of fact has taken an uncontroverted figure and returned a verdict for that figure and that figure only. We have an element, a component of uncontested damages. That's where this case differs from those. That component of uncontested damages. And that's what all of the decision turns on. That's why we refer to Bradner, and that's how we reach the decision that this verdict is insufficient as a matter of law. Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case, please.